Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I have already conveyed my enthusiasm in the pre-introduction to this program, but I'll sound it once again, but with some moderation. Richard Epstein really is a dazzling intellect, but he offends, or at least he doesn't offend, he annoys or confuses many people because he puts his dazzling intellect to work essentially along what might be called conservative lines. Though he himself would resist conservative, rather you would settle for, if we had to designate you with one term, you would settle for...
Classical liberal would be the best.
Classical liberal or libertarian.
Actually, there's a real difference between the two of them. For popular discourse, libertarian just means small government.
Mm-hmm. And
so it's certainly a very accurate description. But when you start getting more technical within the philosophical tradition, a libertarian is somebody who essentially believes that the only justification for the use of public force is to make people keep their promises or to prevent them from engaging in acts of fraud or aggression against other individuals. And that means it's very difficult to figure out how a libertarian taxes in order to fund common expenses or uses the eminent domain power in order to secure properties for the government by a coercive taking upon payment of just compensation. Classical liberal allows for both of
those. That is perfectly acceptable to me as a way of designating you.
Good.
And indeed, it leads me directly to a sentence or two from the first few pages of your new pamphlet, one might call it, or broadside, part of a very interesting series turned out by Encounter Books, run by an old friend of ours, not infrequently a guest on this program whenever he's in Chicago, namely Roger Kimball. At any rate, back to Richard Epstein and to Why Progressive Institutions Are Unsustainable, the title. And here's the sentence, or a few sentences. Bad policies rest on an unsound worldview. So this nation, and he means us, the
yes.
U.S., so this nation has reached a crossroads in its choice of first principles. The nation must choose between the oft-rejected classical liberalism of its founding period and the modern progressive stance that served as the foundation of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal.
That's the choice. Look, I mean, it's actually
I was right in my pre-introduction when I said that progressivism really took hold under FDR.
It took hold. There's a distinction to be made. As a political movement that had success, it took hold under FDR. As an intellectual movement, essentially, progressivism actually is defined as that sort of new republic kind of crowd, John Dewey, and so forth.
And the first presidential figure to use the term, in fact, was the other Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And from 19, and there was a progressive Bull Moose Party, right, in 19, running in 1912. So the movement generally is dated as between 1900 and 1932. And then the moment the New Deal comes over, we're out of the progressive period, but we're implementing progressive ideas. And it took an enormous, how do we say it, transition of the basic constitutional structure in order to allow the New Deal to take root. And essentially, it took place along two separate lines, one having to deal with federalism and separation of powers, and the other having to do with property and contract rights. On the first one, the classical liberal theory says better safe than sorry. So essentially, it tries to place a variety of impediments upon the way in which government could act. So that means that you don't like the amalgamation of power in the hands of administrative agencies. So you look at the Constitution, see no provision for independent agencies, and you declare they are none.
That government governs best which governs least.
Well, the problem with that maxim is you govern least when you don't govern at all, right? So, you know, you've got to find the optimal size of small government, and unfortunately that maxim—
But there are those who favor not governing at all. They call themselves anarchists.
Yes, or the anarcho-libertarian tradition, of which I'm not a part,
yeah.
Right? And that development that the administrative agencies were generally all right actually was ushered in by a man named, I think it was Sutherland, George Sutherland, in a case called Humphrey's Executor, which made it quite clear that you could have independent agencies operate independent of the president in terms of their power to remove. That is, you could entrench them. This is a fine and powerful way to essentially give you expertise without political accountability. But to give you the two modern examples of this, if you look, for example, at the Dodd-Frank bill and you talk about its consumer czar, one of the reasons why there's a fight over one of my former students, Richard Cordray, an able man in many ways, is that the statute says he's to be entrenched for a five-year term. And getting him out essentially requires major malfeasance in office, which means that Obama could appoint him. The next president will have nothing to do with him, though he's making executive-type decisions. And then it's only the president thereafter that can do it for another five-year term. And if you look at the jobs bill, which is a terrible confection of all sorts of things, one of the provisions there is to take the distribution of public funds for highway monies and to put it into a new agency, which will be headed by a czar, which has a six-year term. Again, not removable for cause. So one of the things that the progressives like to do is to entrench their professional people into power and not to let it be subject to the kinds of political pressures that a president or a Congress is supposed to be done.
Was czardom always there, and has it just been renamed in the Obama administration, or have they really tinkered with the very appointment process?
No, I think it's fair to say that some willingness to have very strong administrators was always a part of the progressive movement. One of its leaders, by the way, was none other than Herbert Hoover, who was, in fact, exactly that kind of figure when he was in the Secretary of Commerce under Coolidge. So it's an earlier tendency. What has happened, essentially, is the legal environment has so changed that in the olden days, you had one device in order to insulate these guys from political power. But when you get to the more modern statutes, they pile one device on top of another. And when you put the whole bunch of them together, it really is not only a fourth branch of government, it's completely unaccountable to anybody else.
Define classic liberalism in opposition to progressivism.
Well, on the limited government side, progressives are deeply classical liberals are deeply suspicious of all the delegated powers that goes to administrative agencies who make rules on the basis of supposed expertise. So to give you a vivid illustration, if you're a classical liberal and you look at a labor contract and you know basic principles of contract law, you think you can handle those things. If you're a progressive, you say, union structures are really very unique. We have to have an entire different law of contract and a different regulatory system in order to handle them. So you create the expertise that's associated with the National Labor Relations
Board. Who is
the
founding figure intellectually? Is it Adam Smith, or do you have to go back to Montesquieu or some of those
books? I mean, on the classical liberal side?
Yeah.
Well, one of the greatnesses about a tradition like this is there is no one single founder.
The ideas have been there for a long time.
Well, you certainly see some portion of it in Aristotle, although he had many other things.
Uh-huh.
There's no question when you start talking about the subjective theory of value and the need for assurance, Thomas Hobbes, although he's an authoritarian in terms of his governance structure, is the first man to explicate how contracts work in a really persuasive way and why it is that enforcement requires government power behind them. John Locke becomes an important figure because of the protection of lives, liberties, and estates, and the notion that power and property begin from the bottom up rather than from the top down, so it's an attack on royal power. David Hume was, of course, a great skeptic on large numbers of things, and if you look at his three principles of sound governance and his ethics, it turns out they're taken almost word for word from the basic principles of property, contract, and tort as they existed under Justinian. Remember, he was a Scotsman, he was a lawyer, and Scots law is based on Roman law in a more direct way than common law. James Madison certainly counts as a founder, and as you mentioned, Adam Smith. I think it's fair to say
One might add Burke.
Yes. I think the founding period, to some extent, at an arbitrary numbers, in somewhere around 1800. And after that, you cease to be classical liberal in sentiment.
And our so-called founding fathers knew that tradition very well.
Well, they knew it, I mean, in an extraordinary way.
They drew upon it.
Well, first of all, I mean, they were all trained in classical subjects. I mean, I was at Princeton recently. Then went back and did my homework since I was asked to give a lecture about James Madison and so forth. He was a Princeton man, and he was trained in mathematics and he trained in classics and all the standard stuff, so that by the time, you know, he got involved in the Federalist Papers, he was 36 years of age when he was writing them, the man was a highly cultured individual. And if you go back and you read the boring bits, they're all about classical analogies, which was very much the style of
at
writing
Princeton,
at that time.
You must have been talking to Robbie George's outfit.
I'm not going to be invited by some of the other outfits down there. Yes, I was invited by Robbie to speak to his
group. Which is named for Madison, I believe.
Well, it is the Madison Institute.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I had two very nice conversations there. One of them was a public lecture in which the topic was corruption and related very much to the themes of the broadside and a little bit to the book on the rule of law, slightly more abstract theme.
So much for the general intellectual background. Mm. We're about to pause to serve capitalism in our own way with a few commercials. When we return, I want to zero in on the works and ways of the present administration.
All right. We'll go from then to now.
It happens to be a matter of some interest that the president of the United States these days, Barack Obama, was a colleague of yours at the Law School of the University of Chicago. And when he was first elected, you had some things to say about the kind of colleague he was. More recently, you've had some things to say about the kind of president he has been. And we need to directly examine your evaluation of the man and, more important, of his administration.
Sure.
Directly back to Richard Epstein after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And returning to a sometime colleague at the University of Chicago, Richard Epstein, because also he's a colleague of all sorts of people down in Greenwich Village in New York at New York University.
Actually, I'm emeritus at Chicago now, but I'm a senior lecturer.
But so you're still coming in.
I come in and I teach every spring quarter and I spend the summer.
But you don't always get close enough to the microphone.
Yes, that is a mortal sin in this business.
And we are drawing from this, we'll call it this, we'll use their term. Back to the encounter broadside,
yes,
number 26. And in the broadside, you say, you title it, Why Progressive Institutions Are Unsustainable. That seems to be a judgment of a progressive administration now in office.
Yes, it is. Let me say, in terms of the current administration, what it's trying to do is to be a second or a third wave of progressive, actually a fourth wave. First, you have Wilson, and things are very small, and the progressive changes are going to be relatively modest. You get Roosevelt, you add more on, they're going to be more dramatic.
The basic measure is the amount of governmental takeover of what otherwise wasn't done by government.
Yeah, and so, you know, in the beginning of the New Deal, government was 6% of the economy, and then by the time it was done, it was 9% of the economy. But when you try to go, as Obama has done, from, say, 20 or 25% of the economy or even more, that's a much more difficult thing because you're really cutting into the productive base upon which government
What have been
rests.
The major areas of attempted takeover?
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear what these tend to be. The two most conspicuous are, of course, the remaking of the healthcare markets on both the public and the private side, expansion of Medicaid coverage, and the rapid change of the private market. And then there are the Financial Services Acts, which covers all sorts of things. There's consumer fraud. It turns out there's systematic risk. A topic on which I spent a lot of time in fruitless litigation was dealing with debit card reform. There is also a third statute which is worthy of note, which is the Patent Reform Act, which took place this past year, ironically entitled the America Invents Act, slightly propagandistic, and it's, of course, instructive to note that the people who were most opposed to the act were the inventors, as opposed to the large companies who were generally on the opposite side of these patent suits. Those are the three major ones, but there were all sorts of smaller ones. There was a lot of things aren't done by legislation. They're done by ruling, so you get the Mercury ruling coming out from the EPA. And, you know, the administration will say it will cost you $10 billion to implement and give you $60 billion in benefits. And somebody else will actually invert the numbers and say, my God, this thing will cost far more than that and give you many fewer benefits. And you have to decide who's telling the truth. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to go from a very large base to an even larger base. And at this point, you have the following 1-2 punch, which is what I refer to in the book. The first thing is the Obama administration is quite hostile to freedom in markets, particularly in labor markets. You know, they chase after the Boeing company, and then when there's a settlement, everybody drops the case. It turns out that they're very aggressive on overtime enforcement, very vigorous with respect to enforcing the civil rights laws in all sorts of places where you don't need one after effort after another to try to create a favorable environment for unions, requiring posting of notices everywhere, including non-union shops about rights, trying to speed up organizational campaigns and so forth, and to do this without the concurrence of Congress. What all of these things do, unfortunately, is by limiting freedom of contract, is it tends to mean that labor markets are less productive than before.
And the consequence
is you have a smaller wage base or income base on which you could run your transfer programs.
Let me read the first paragraph or less of your broadside.
Oh,
the modern economic malaise in the United States, and that rather reminds one echoes of Jimmy Carter.
Yes.
Who never actually spoke of malaise, I think.
No, he just practiced it.
The modern economic malaise in the United States is captured by two numbers. The first is the decline in average family income, which has slid for the past 3 years and now stands at the same level, adjusted for inflation, that it was in 1996. Yes. The second is the persistent level of unemployment at 9.1%, which excludes those who are underemployed or have, in frustration, given up their search for jobs. Everyone across the political spectrum deplores the result and wishes to reverse the trend. But this unanimity of ends gives way to a fierce difference of opinion on means, just what should be done.
Yes. I mean, that's the Lenin question, right?
What is to be done was a famous broadside.
The guy who is a lot more successful at pamphleting than I am, yes.
But the administration now in power, and they've done 3 years or so, would argue that it would have been much worse but for the measures they took.
Well, I mean, the difficulty with that, of course, is it's never verifiable unless you have an independent theory to verify it. And in this particular case, I think the argument that you'd make would go the opposite way. There are two things that are generally thought to influence unemployment rates if you look at macroeconomists, which I am not. And they start looking at the monetary policy and the low interest rates. And you can only drive those things down to zero. After you get to negative rates, they become destructive. Or you could try and force money into the economy by selling off cash and, you know, taking bonds and things like that. And the other thing, in addition to that, is fiscal policy, where you try to create stimulus programs of one thing and another.
They did a good deal of it.
Well, they did a good deal of it. And this is my basic reaction to that. It turns out that when you just make pure monetary shifts, what you do is you change the identity of the claimants to particular resources. So if I take a bunch of dollars and I shower them on you, but I don't shower them on me, you now have a larger fraction of resources than I have. But the pool itself does not increase by virtue of the change in the number of claims against it. What happens when you take tax one group and give it to another group, you spend a lot of resources on the transfers, but you don't do anything to create real wealth. So the presumptive effect of all of these kinds of transfer programs in the initial phase is that they're going to be negative unless you could show some reason why it is that this transfer rather than any other transfer is going to do well. At this point, the American left gets quite confused about two objectives. One of them is the Keynesian objective of trying to increase aggregate demand. And if what you're worried about is aggregate demand, you don't frankly care who gets the money so long as they spend it. But the other thing you worry about is inequality of wealth. So now you want to give the new chits to the people at the bottom. And the standard argument, which turns out to be wrong, is that if you give it to people who are somewhat less well endowed, they will use a larger fraction of it for current consumption than people who are more well endowed, and that will be a stimulus. The problem is, if there is actually an expectation of falling income in the future, it turns out that saving rates will be much higher as people try to equalize their income across different periods. So that stimulus program, it turned out, failed. That is, they were wrong on every prediction about payment to past debts, about current expenditures and savings.
Now, Mr. Obama made it very clear during the campaign that he favored transfer payments.
Yes.
The great canonical moment was just saying to Joe the Plumber, we're going to spread the wealth around a little bit.
Well, you know, you spread it around. What happens is the only way you can spread it around is to reduce its total.
But didn't that appeal to the American public?
No, actually.
Didn't that help to elect him?
I don't think so, actually. I think it was one of the few points in which he was on the defensive. I mean, you know, Senator McCain was not quick on the uptake on anything. But if you actually look at American sentiments with respect to the inequality of wealth before this thing became a fever pitch issue, the general attitude that most people had was not to care very much about it so long as their own opportunities for advancement
were pretty
good.
What did elect Obama? Was it just everybody wanted to somehow get rid of Bush and disdain what Bush represented, and therefore you vote for the other party?
No.
Or did he make promises which really excited and enthused those who voted for him?
No. What really happened is one day, or a very short period of time, namely during the period of the great financial meltdown in September, John McCain said, we have to have time out, cancel the debate. And then when he went to Washington, he had nothing to say. And Obama came up with the single best line of the campaign: I think a president has to be able to multitask. Before that particular incident, I think McCain was actually ahead by 2 or 3 points in the polls. After, he was down by 4 or 5 and there it stayed. So, I mean, there really was a defining moment which had very little to do with hope and change. It was just the clear perception that our friend McCain was either a little too old or a little bit too slow or a little bit too clueless to do this job. And the way in which he responded under crisis gave a real advantage to Obama, who had
some strength to his step. Single line, did it?
Because if you just look at the change before and after, it's pretty dramatic. And afterwards, it's basically in a holding pattern.
It would be comparable then as an effective single killer single line. It would be comparable to Ronald Reagan saying in that one debate Jimmy Carter at the very end, ask yourself, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?
Yeah, or the other kinds of lines. It's actually slightly different because this was the blunder by McCain. Yeah. That set up Obama. What happened is Reagan was running off a situation where he had a deeply unpopular president who projected an absolutely kind of gloomy disposition to the world at large. And notwithstanding his 60-odd years of age, remember, he was 69 when he was elected, born 1911, whatever it is, Reagan actually presented a little bit of an optimism. And, of course, one of the things that's very clear about Reagan, which I don't think most people understood, is he did not mind being consistently underestimated by his opponents. And he played the hillbilly all the time. In fact, people who know him well said when he had a copy of Locke or Hobbes on his desk, it was thumbed up and there was all sorts of marginal notes that he had actually read the great classical liberals and they had shaped his thoughts. And if you look at the speeches that he did when he was sort of out of office and in the interregnum, they're all little homilies which show a fairly consistent small government view. So the man was armed with a coherent political philosophy when he started office.
We're about to pause for an update on the news. We'll go to the newsroom and David Jennings in just a moment. But let me put you on notice. What I would like very much to get into when we return after that is to examine not merely what's been happening in this country, but what's been happening in the Western world.
Yeah.
The fact is we've got nearly failed administrations or failed states.
Everywhere.
In the developed world as well as in the underdeveloped world.
It's the same disease in different manifestations.
Well, I want to look at France, at Italy, at Germany, at the Scandinavian countries, at Spain, at Greece, of course, and ask what they tell us about ourselves. We'll be directly back to Richard Epstein after the update on the news from David Jennings.
How long is that?
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are back with Richard Epstein, drawing from his recently published broadside, they call it, pamphlet, one might call it, very readable, very important, Why Progressive Institutions Are Unsustainable. I should add that I think I may have said it once before that the most recent full book by Richard Epstein is titled Design for Liberty, Private Property, Public Administration, and the Rule of Law. And that is just published by
Harvard Press.
By Harvard University Press. It's another coming university with some attraction, I would guess.
It's been around a long time.
I reinstate the simple, basic question. Apply this analysis to what's been happening to our cousin countries over in Western Europe, basically.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the first thing to understand is that sometimes Americans believe that our distinctive constitutional arrangements insulate us from some of the political pressures that you have in European countries, which don't have any strong vested rights under a constitution, tend to run out of a parliamentary system. That's mistaken. The key feature on the American side that sort of sets the stage is that when it comes to areas of comprehensive economic regulation or taxation or the creation of positive rights, all of the traditional guarantees on the individual liberty side, that was the second revolution I talked about with the New Deal, those have all essentially been wiped away. And so you have to have conduct so egregious that no political body would pass it in order to have it unconstitutional. So we're basically, in terms of the ability of having judicial restraint over political institutions, at the same position that the Europeans are. And at that point,
did they get there sooner?
They got there a little sooner, and they probably maybe are a little bit more intense than us. But I think most of that difference doesn't come from the constitutional
order. And are
they
in deeper trouble than us?
They are, because they've gone further down the road. I think American individualism, often abused but sometimes a very useful concept, has made a difference. I think there's less hereditary kind of preferences in this country than overseas. There's more decentralization because we don't have a single national government. We have state governments.
They have also established social welfare programs of much vaster.
Yeah, but that's because
it was Lord Beveridge worked out the post-war British system who said that the intention was to provide security from the cradle to the grave.
Well, they try that. But what happens is that you can only tax what's produced. And if you create these institutions, you don't produce what you need to do. So the basic dilemma that you have in America is done in slightly greater intensity in places overseas, including England, which used to be a much more classical liberal country before 1906 and the Trade Disputes Act and so forth. And it's the same political game. I remember, to give you a story about this, to show about the similarities, I had an English guest whose name I forget, who was in the United States one day, and he was talking about what is common in England, which is to have retroactive legislation which renders the illegal or subject to taxation conduct that was legal or free from tax at the time that it was undertaken. And he said, of course, you'd never have a thing like that in the United States. And I said, are you familiar with Ussery against Turner Elkhorn, pulling a little bit of rank on him? And of course, he hadn't heard it, but it's the case case in which Justice Marshall said that when it comes to worrying about the shared economic burdens, the state's entitled to move them whatever way it wants. And so they imposed a retroactive tax on coal companies in order to take care of the black lung disease that had been suffered by some people, even though all the things that had been done by the companies, including the compensation programs they had in place and the safety precautions that were supposed to be enforced, all of them were fully respected. And his view was you could just do that backwards. I said, look, this is what happens in the United States. We have a strong principle of property law, and then we announce that if it's foreseeable that the government will cheat, it's entitled to cheat. So foresight of government misbehavior becomes a justification for government misbehavior. So there is a 10%, 15% difference between us. But the real difference between the United States and Europe is partly the cultural one and partly that American state separation does create a certain degree of competition between states, and that tends to slow up the level of government dominance.
Is Europe facing economic / financial disaster?
Well, you know,
are they close to the brink?
They're certainly, shall we say, teetering in very uneven situations. The root of the problem in this regard is slightly different from the ones I've just talked about before. There is a European Union, but it's quite the opposite of the United States. For example, in the United States, all the military powers are concentrated in the center, and in the European Union, they're all the independent roles of the various nations. But what they do is they have a unitary monetary policy, i.e. the euro, but they have no central fiscal policy. So what happens is they have to try to figure out how various kinds of mandates from the center will persuade the separate governments when it comes to their own expenditure and stimulus programs what to do. And what happens is they all don't play the same game, so that you now have under a common currency Germany, which is a relatively strong economy, and Greece and Spain, all which are basket cases. And if you're trying to figure out what would happen if you had separate currencies, the mark would get stronger and the other currencies would get weaker in relationship to them, right? Well, now that you have a single currency, all of a sudden you're trying to have an upper and a downer at the same time, and they start to slowly pull apart. And the great unknown question is whether or not the euro will come apart on the grounds that you cannot have a single currency which has to be completely valued one way in one country and one way in the other country, and then have to prop it up with monies from the central bank. I think the odds on that are 50-50.
Mrs. Thatcher's greatest lasting gift
was
to
keeping the pound separate.
Is to keep the pound separate, not to go into the euro.
Well, I think she was right. I mean, in fact, look, my view about this in general at the time was that I thought this was a great idea to the extent that you made it as a common market trade zone. That is, you got rid of barriers between states so you'd have more gains from trade. The bad side of that was that sometimes when you get rid of barriers within the country, you put up protective barriers to New Zealand food coming into the European Union and so forth. But all things considered, it probably was a sensible trade. But the moment you start going for harmonization out of Brussels and to a single currency, or what happens is the really regulatory policies become much powerful. So the harmonization in Europe is always in favor of more restriction on labor markets, capital markets, and so forth. So instead of having competition, like we have amongst the various states, you have this centralization. And that leads to a kind of statism, which I think is difficult to get rid of. And then you have the fractured policy with the euro. So you put these two things together, and it turns out that you find yourself under really unbearable pressure. It's a case of either too strong or too weak, but certainly not just right.
On and off over recent years, we've often discussed on this program a vision of the future laid out by Sam Huntington some 10 or 12 years ago.
Clash of Civilizations.
The Clash of Civilizations. We focus, and of course, Huntington, we've discussed it only recently again on this program, but I will remind you and our listeners that Huntington, I don't have to remind you, you know all of it,
no,
but I'll
no.
remind our listeners that Huntington said there are two great clashes that are coming. One is the West with China.
Yes.
And the other is the West against
Islam.
Yeah. Mark Stein, who's a wonderfully brilliant, rather eccentric guy who I've always said does a routine that one would have to call apocalyptic stand-up.
Yeah.
Because he's always seeing the worst of everything, but he persuades you. He's been often on this program as well. And in his book of a number of years ago, America Alone, he was already looking at the decline of Europe as Islam moved in, and not only demographically, but also in terms of continued cultural opposition to what Europe represents, continued loyalty to, and indeed eagerness to further facilitate the spread of Islam, a demanding a conservative Sharia-based form of Islam in the Western world. Mark may have overstated it. All the same, there's lots of trouble in England. There's a good deal of trouble in Italy and in France and in the Low Countries with resistant, non-assimilated, non-assimilable representatives of militant Islam. That seems a totally different area and a totally different question from the matters we've been discussing up to now, but I think there probably are connections.
There are connections, first of all.
Don't tell me now. Again, we serve capitalism. Right after the break, you will explain how those two realms...
You're going to the outer limits of my expertise, but I'll give it a shot.
No, I'm interested at all. You'll have a great deal to say on that, I am sure, as we return to Richard Epstein after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to Richard Epstein. There's so much one could go on talking about. I've added one cultural problem rather than economic to seek a category for it, but it overlaps into economic issues, of course. But there are other cultural problems. The plague of political correctness, the rush to legalize sexual diversity and eccentricity, et cetera, et cetera. Well, all of these things have popped up in Western culture in a way that disturbs people who call themselves conservatives.
Yes, it might. And I call myself libertarian, but let me just sort of back up because you started with the temptation of fundamentalism, which I think is actually, in terms of compatibility with legal systems, a much more difficult issue. I mean, the fundamental view of sort of Western civilization, which is shared by both the progressives on the one hand and the classical liberals on the other, is that to some extent, each individual ought to be able to have his own expression of what the good is, so long as he doesn't trespass on the like expressions by other individuals. And so either you're talking about economic liberties or sexual liberties, the two things that you mentioned, both of them essentially are defended by people on the grounds. Well, it's no skin off your back who might sleep with
us. But conservative Islam, and much of Islam is conservative.
Yes.
It takes a very different view.
Nobody has the right to violate fundamental law, which is decreed by a centralized body. Yeah. And essentially to engage in practices which meet with the consent of the other parties with whom you do, has nothing whatsoever to do with these things because they believe, to use the Western term, in a very comprehensive sense of the morals power, where the state can regulate sexual behavior, marriage, you know, divorce and all that stuff.
And should and does.
And does. And that people who descend from that are essentially traitors to the system rather than dissidents. So when you have large communities of people who are fundamentalists and they believe that their law requires X and you think that the political law requires a certain greater diversity, they are going to remain passive resistance against it. And if you push them hard in order to get them to change, you will be met with perhaps even violence.
So is this then a clash of civilizations, which is being enacted in Europe right now and may ultimately reach us?
The American Muslim community turns out to be less cohesive in that particular fashion.
They are more assimilationist.
Yes, than they are overseas. And, of course, one cannot generalize. I mean, if you were to try to ask me, for example, what the fundamental problem in Israel is today, it's exactly the same kind of fundamentalist sort of sectarian state, and it's widely joked in Israel, but with a deep sense of truth to it, that the fundamentalist Jews and the fundamentalist Muslims have more in common with each other than they have with the secular members of either of these parties.
The Haredim could buy Sharia.
Yeah, I mean, sure. I mean, Martin, they could do this. And, you know, Martin Marty at the University of Chicago 25 years ago, when people were worried about the liberation of East Germany, said, no, you know, you got the wrong cloud on the horizon, ladies and gentlemen. It's really this fundamentalism stuff, because there's no way that you could argue with them, because unless you accept their premises, they won't speak to you. And so if you start with a, as it were, an authoritative definition of the good, anything which it excludes is necessarily bad. So I think it's a serious problem. China is a different kind of situation. And I was just there in October giving some lectures at Tsinghua and Beidong University. And, you know, you could not
How's your Mandarin?
My Mandarin is flawless. I can't speak a word of it. Every time I try to say thank you in Chinese, it comes out complete gibberish. But, of course, they are extremely determined to learn and to speak English.
Yeah, I know.
And once somebody in China decides that they're going to accomplish a task, it's simply a linear movement over all obstacles to achieve it. There's a kind of a purposive behavior, which is quite astonishing. What it leaves behind, maybe, it's hard to tell, is a certain degree of imagination and playfulness. You would never describe your German, your Teutonic or Chinese academics as being playful. They are omnivorous in terms of what they read, in terms of what they know. But the fact that they know so much has this odd sense that when it comes to sort of general theory in an international dilemma, they have yet to make their mark. And the same is true of the South Koreans, I think, in the areas that I work, and the Japanese. They are too hierarchical in their educational system. Somebody asked me, what was the greatest advantage that you had when you were a young academic? I said there were two things. One is I was a free man at age 25. That is, I was teaching at that age. And two, I had no mentors. And that meant that I could sort of go to hell in my own way. Most people who do what I did tend to fail at it. And I was just luckier than most because I had a pretty strong sense from a fairly early age as to what I wanted to do. So the Chinese are like this. And they mass very effectively. So, you know, you're talking about 1.5 billion people sitting out there with an increased standard of living of 8 to 10% a year, with a great willingness to sort of squash the little man, which they have with respect to their rurals, and in effect to squash their dissidents, which they do everywhere in the city. They can do things, and when it's good, it's very, very good, and when it's bad, it's hard. So people ask me, you teach property law, what about Chinese zoning law? I said, there is no such thing as Chinese zoning law. The state owns all the land. It gives people leases, and if it decides to revoke the leases, it does so. If it decides to rip down the houses, it does so. And what they will do is they'll set up informal compensation systems based on, strangely enough, Western principles of natural justice.
So there is no classical liberalism in China.
Well, actually, on economic issues among some of the academics.
They've got a free market operation.
Well, yes, if they could keep it apart from the political. There is an illegal version of a Chinese translation of my takings book, which was circulating around Beidong University when I lectured there. Because on those kinds
That's
of
issues. That's very free enterprise.
Well, the book actually was sort of strong property rights and limited government as much as free enterprise. Free enterprise is a sort of an outgrowth of the fundamental protection of private property.
No, what I mean is making the illegal copy.
Yes, well, it was. I mean, well, they often do that. Frankly, my view is they have my implicit blessing. Yeah. When it comes to writing books, you're never in it as an academic for money. You're in it for the hope that you'll have some influence over the way in which the world puts itself together.
But here, the question I'm trying to pursue, and I haven't framed it too carefully, is there any way of explaining or ultimately reordering our economic problems by reference back to our cultural problems or developments, the ones that I've listed and into an agenda?
Let me just give you a kind of a tidbit. If you ask most libertarians of under 35 why they're libertarians,
they read what's her name?
Ayn Rand?
Yeah.
It's not even that. It turns out to be the drug culture. That is, it
basically legalized drugs.
Legalized drugs, which I'm not opposed to in any sense, but I would have thought that that was the tail, not the dog.
And
the
Bill dog Buckley put the conservative imprimatur even on that policy.
Yes, and of course, I mean, it is counterproductive, like, you know, prohibition. And if you're talking about drugs like, you know, marijuana and so forth that have some legitimate uses, e.g. for medical care and so on, it's not anything that I wish to oppose. When it comes to hard drugs that drives people to theft. My own preferred solution is let them take it, but don't use it as an excuse when they commit a crime. And if it turns out they need help, they can buy it. So that what we do right now is we punish the hell out of the behavior, and then we subsidize its cure, which means, in effect, that we have this very elaborate system in which if we did neither of those two things, we would be probably better off in terms of the public expenditure saved and the lives not lost by just letting it all run out in a more traditional fashion. In terms of the sexual issues, my own view about this is it's basically a red herring in terms of the way in which things work. I mean, I have lots of children, you know, three children and so forth of different ages. I know a lot of kids now between 35, my daughter, and 27, my son. And what turns out to be the most common feature about so many of them is they form paired relationships, but they're reluctant to get married until they're relatively late stage. But it's not as though they're promiscuous or wild. It's a fear of commitment rather than a desire for lascivious behavior, which seems to drive this, but it doesn't seem to affect anything in the way that I've seen in terms of their general character and the way in which they enter into business. Some of these people are perfectly sensible conservatives. Some of them are liberal. The connection between whom you marry and what your politics are in the United States is very weak now. I'm always fond of saying that when I go to Federalist Society, you know, the conservative law students, and a lot of my students invite me to their weddings, I have Jewish people marrying Zoroastrians. I have Chinese people marrying Protestants and all the rest of this stuff. There just doesn't seem to to be any difference in that level of interaction which can be attributed to, in any way, shape, or form, American political attitude. So that's just kind of fine. Even, you know, same-sex marriages, my view is, don't worry about it. If you don't like it, the only thing that Barney Frank ever said that made true sense was, if you don't like my same-sex marriage wedding, don't attend. And, you know, that's your protection, and treat that as a freedom of association. On the other hand, when somebody says, you know, if you're a church and you now have to ordain women or gay rabbis or whatever it is, then you become authoritarian. And so I think it's real important to separate out these kinds of issues so that what you oppose is the willingness of one group to assert its domination over another rather than to attack the kinds of preferences. One of the very healthy rules that everybody should follow is the mere fact that you, meaning me, are offended by the way in which other people behave is not in itself sufficient warrant to tell them that they have to do otherwise. This is a very important amendment of John Mill's
Palm principles. Well, in all of this, you're sounding very much the full force of libertarianism. Indeed, Ron Paul, if he were listening tonight, would probably borrow some of your phraseology.
He's a very contradictory figure, as you know. He's an isolationist in foreign affairs, which I am not. He's a gold bug, which I am not. It turns out he's not even a particularly strong international free trader, which I am. There is certainly
He's not as bright as you, either.
Well, he's also old. What can I tell to a young man like you?
Yeah.
He's a political type. There were some very disturbing stories recently about some of his supporters being nativist. And one of the great tragedies of being a classical liberal is that it turns out that every gun-toting survivalist who comes out of the Montana hills bearing weapons to kill people inside the cities calls himself a libertarian. You get kind of nervous when you start seeing the really rebellious and anarchistic and destructive individuals who don't believe in markets but believe in a weird form of self-fulfillment, having your label and taking it out. In fact, the single hardest thing about being a classical liberal is sometimes the company you're forced to keep. And to some extent, you know, Ron Paul is not my man. Ayn Rand is not my woman in these things. You know, as you said, you mentioned the people from the tradition from which I came. And they were all interested in structures. And it turns out they weren't as Ayn Rand was interested when she talks about somebody like John Galt, I guess is the name of the character. We're not interested in great heroes standing up against the rest of the world. You give me the structure. And you know what? If everybody decides not to become a heroic entrepreneur, and some people just want to work for somebody else, in a libertarian world, that's just fine. In fact, if you're going to have leaders, you have to have followers. What we believe in is if you let people sort themselves by role through voluntary association, on average, the right people will get to the right place at the right time. And you stress the word on average, right? Because there's no perfection in this world.
Get to the right place. The right people will get to the right place at the right time.
And now it's time for a break, I assume.
Well, that may well be true, say, in professional life and in artistic life and even in intellectual competition and so on. One does wonder about American politics. Maybe one should wonder generally about politics in the world of republics the world of democracies. I cannot resist, though you may find it a bit of an annoyance, I cannot resist asking you, before we stop for some newscasts, which we're about to do, to take all that you've been saying and somehow relate it to, if indeed there is a way of relating it, to our present real politics. Of course, we're caught in this presidential season, and we've had an awful lot of activity not only on the Republican side, where all the candidates are getting pretty nasty to one another by now. It was predictable they would, even though Newt Gingrich in an early debate said he's not here to criticize any Republicans.
Oh, yeah, fat chance.
But on the side of the administration, there are some pretty strong undertakings as well, including they're now inviting kids to give them the names of all of their relatives who are Republican, and also to go to family parties and talk down or re-educate the older folks who've got the wrong attitudes. It sounds a touch Stalinoidal to me. It sounds rather like thought control of a sort that was practiced elsewhere and elsewhere. All of this is just vague setup. Asking you to comment on present American politics, which I trust you will be willing to do after we pause for a full update on the evening's news from David Jennings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And our listeners may be wondering when they can pose a question or offer a thought to Richard Epstein. You can do that after the 11:15 break. We're going to go for another 10 minutes or so. And then after that break, we'll go to the phones. But we'll open the phone lines at this very moment. If you want to pose a question and don't mind waiting in line just a bit, Get in there right now. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. And for internet listeners, wherever they may be located, whether in Yellowknife, Saskatchewan, or Merida, Yucatan, or over in Sydney, Australia, if you want to get to us, the best way, of course, is via email. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Or for phones again, 312-591-7200. Get your emails in, yet certainly get in the phone calls if you don't mind standing in queue for just a bit, and we will be with you shortly. But before that shortly expires, let me just say it quickly and get out of the way. Present American politics. Can you relate that to all that we've been talking about?
Yes. I mean, one of the problems that we have in American politics is that neither political party is consistently and thoroughly classical liberal in its organizations. If this is the way in which you get growth, which is low and steady taxation over a strong system of markets and moderate distribution policies, the Republicans, you know, they champion ethanol subsidies. And the great tragedy in America in many cases is that each of these particular parties has some special deal that it wants. And oftentimes the political compromise you get is not that the one side knocks out the other and the other side knocks out the one. It's that each one acquiesces in the program of the other. And every time you get one of these kinds of special transfer programs, the pie gets a little bit smaller and the government gets a little bit larger. And if you do it enough times, what started off as a kind of an innocent gander becomes a very serious kind of interaction. So the theme of these books is essentially you have to find ways to stop it. In the Design for Liberty book, which you haven't talked about, what I try to do is to go through at some length about how if you understand the institutions of property, contract, and tort, that is, how people acquire property, how they transfer it, and how they protect it, and the institution of eminent domain and taxation, the central feature that you're trying to do is to limit the discretion of government officials to decide how to take the wealth from A and give it to B. And what happens is if you look at all the major decisions in the United States, the transfer element dominates the productive element. So if you listen to the president talk about all these terrible millionaires and billionaires and so forth, what you have—
Many of whom fund him, of course.
Yes, we know that, less than did before. What you don't understand is if you really push as hard as you do on the productive side, their wealth is not given by nature. It's not an invariant fixture no matter what happens to the rest of us. In good times when dividends and stock prices appreciate, the rich tend to do very well. In bad time when these things start to crater, they do very badly. And one of the actual unspoken problems of today is that the rich aren't rich enough to fund the entire system. So that if you take the peak at 2007 before all the crisis hit, and then you compare it to 2009, and you look at that select group over, say, 200, 250,000 people, their income totals are down by 30% in aggregates, with the biggest hits being in the highest group at the 10 million and above. So then you look at this, that means that the tax revenues they generate go down as well. And what you find out is that even though there's no change in tax brackets, the total level collected in taxation in the United States now is at an all-time low in the post-war era because the rich are gone.
Are you then at the point of asserting or at least implying that it's a Tweedledum Tweedledee thing and it makes no difference whether we've got Democrats or Republicans running
the show? No, I'm not saying that at
all.
I think what's fair to say is that to the extent that one sees both parties having vices, it's an accurate statement. But if you look at the sort of the cardinal legislation, and I mentioned three at the outset, the Republicans were on the right side of the financial bill and trying to moderate its effects. They certainly were on the right side with respect to the health care system, where the best plan is probably something like the sort that Mitch Daniels does in Tennessee, in Indiana and so forth. And on the patent bill, which I think is really quite a terrible piece of legislation, it was the stampede in which both parties, I think, were on the wrong side of the issue. So I think if you actually look at some of the pitched battles on progressivity and so forth, in general, you will find more sense from the Republican side than from the Democratic side. But there are some startling bipartisan lapses. I mean, you know, the control of lead type legislation and so forth, which has gone to a level of virtual insanity. The statute was passed almost by acclamation, I think, in Congress. So you have a lot of bipartisan regulatory policies, which principled people ought to oppose, which are supported by both sides.
What does the economy need if restoration of some sort is to be achieved? And does it make a difference which party? And do the parties make a difference with regard to the potential of restorability.
Yes. The Democrats, the only thing that you could hope for them is that they will slow down their effort to continue to centralize the economy. I regard them as, by and large, hopeless on these kinds of issues because they are driven by people who say that no matter what the government program is, it has no negative effect on production at the time that production is systematically down. When you start talking about the Republicans, the only thing that will do this, in my judgment, is not a combination of fiscal and monetary policy. It's a systematic, thorough program of deregulation with respect to the operation of standard labor markets and real estate markets. You have to expand the base, and the only way you could do that is to expand trade. So you have to be much more aggressive on free trade policies with respect to foreign nations.
And much more restrictive of union power
in the United States. You have to get rid of some of the high progressive taxes. My own position is that capital gains rates ought to be zero, because if you redeploy the capital to more efficient businesses, what you get in dividends and wages will more than offset the
capital
losses.
You also, I think, favor a flat tax.
I've always been a flat tax man, along with John Locke.
How do you reason that?
Well, essentially, if you recall what I said to you earlier, the essential feature of public institutions is to allow the existence of intelligent government coercion with a minimum of government discretion. And what the government needs revenue for is to supply a certain set of what they call public non-excludable goods. Where you get the revenue from doesn't influence the nature of the good. So what a flat tax does is it means that you will reduce the likelihood that one faction will be able, and this is in Madison's terms, to put all the burden of taxation on another group while keeping a majority of the benefits on its own. Taxation itself only handles one side of it. You need to have a fairly narrow definition of public good in order to make sure that the payments don't offset all the good things you could do by flat taxes on the other side. But if you do this, it will make a difference. In some small countries like Estonia, they try it. And what they find, in effect, is that the level of impulse improvement in productivity is so sufficiently large that the actual taxes that you need in order to fund the economy continue to go down. That is, if you assume that you could keep government functions relatively constant in size, they ought not to expand equally with wealth. And if that's the case, you should be able to get lower flat tax rates and higher productivity.
Dr. Pangloss in Voltaire's Candide is famous for saying, "It is the best of all possible worlds." If we look at the possible world that confronts us right now, and you have to think about voting, you are a citizen, you probably use that electoral privilege routinely, who would you vote for? Or rather, who would you like to have the opportunity to vote for?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things about the current situation is there are on the political landscapes no heroes. If you ask me, the one figure who seems to me to have the clearest sense of what I would like to do, it would probably be Mitch Daniels, and he took himself out of this election a very long time ago. And if you compare, for example, his health care plan with modest redistribution and careful structuring with the nightmare that's coming out of the central administration through the Obamacare program, you see the difference between a light, deft touch on the one hand and a hugely complicated one on the other. Amongst the Republican candidates, there are a lot of them are flakes. I mean, you know, it's clear that Gingrich is not very stable. Michelle Bachmann is not very stable. Ron Paul has some real difficulties on these things. The only one who's stable is Mitt Romney, and of course he's stable but not particularly libertarian. And I would certainly prefer him to the other candidates and think that he's actually the only candidate, given the current complexion of American politics, on the Republican side who has a chance to unseat Obama.
Why don't the kinds of people who you favor agree to run for president? Why didn't Mitch Daniels do so?
Well, his wife and daughters told him that we do not want to withstand the kind of ordeal to which you will be subject.
He had been married and divorced and then remarried the same woman, and that might be a source of embarrassment.
I don't know the personal circumstances. I just know the complication on this thing. Yeah. But generally, what you see is the incredible battering that able people take when they go into public life is a strong deterrent for all but the hardy to undertake it, which means that the people who want to go into government have almost a megalomaniacal determination to take it. And that's why you see, you know, Gingrich-like features, people out there.
I haven't made much in our conversation of the fact that you and Barack Obama were once colleagues at the Law School of the University of Chicago. Did you have any sense when you first met him and got to know him that he had some sort of public future in mind?
Yeah, we always had that sense. I mean, the way the man carries himself, cocks his head, listens to you, his whole physical bearing speaks of this sense. But what was always the interesting feature is not that you saw him very often, because he was running three jobs and we were just one of them, but he always managed to get you to speak, and he never could reveal to you what it was that he was thinking. He had this incredible ability for self-control. I have no such abilities whatsoever. Somebody asked me what I think, I just let it out. And, of course, you see my immense political career coming in consequence.
That's why, frankly, you make a better, by a far better, guest on a radio program than Barack Obama did the one time he was here.
Well, thank you for the compliment.
But he was here a long time ago. He had just published his first book.
Yeah. And Dreams of My Father.
Yeah, he hadn't even gone yet to the state Senate. We are going to pause right now. Then we're going to go to the phones. 312-591-7200 for any question you want to pose to Richard Epstein. 312-591-7200. The lines are open. We look forward to your calls. Similarly, for those listening over the Internet, you can reach us via email. The email address, again, is extension720@WGNradio.com. Get your calls and emails in quickly. We will be with you directly after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly to your phone calls, 312-591-7200, for questions and comments. They don't have to be questions, to Richard Epstein. We've been drawing from a pamphlet he's done recently, rather than going into any of his major books, and all of them are major, but the name of the pamphlet, which is published by Encounter Books, is Why Progressive Institutions Are Unsustainable. The newest full-length book by Richard Epstein is titled Design for Liberty, Private Property, Public Administration, and the Rule of Law. That's published by Harvard University Press. 312-591-7200. Our first caller is Joe. Good evening.
Hi, Milt. Thanks for taking my call. The question I had, with the European debt crisis, how, you know, the U.S. stock market's had stops and starts. You know, some good news, some bad news. It's been up to 12.8. You know, now it's, yeah, it went down almost 11. What do you think, Professor, will happen going forward the next year or so?
Well, I've been consistent on this for the last 4 years. I think we're in a relatively narrow band, and the medians will remain pretty constant, but I think the variance on given days will be fairly high. So you'll see some 300-plus days, some 200-minus days. We've yet to get back to 1,300, I think, or 13,000 on the stock market. We rarely go below 11,000. We remember we have not had a new high now since, I guess it was, what, October in 2007, which means that we're 4 years running. It will be a time, I think, before we actually beat that number. And if you adjust for inflation, you may be looking at 5 years. The American economy is not in a depression. It's not in a free fall. There's still a huge amount of entrepreneurial zeal about. But most of the regulatory moves are a damper on the way that this operates. And so what you do is you have a battle between technology on the one hand and innovation. And then on the other hand, what you do is you have regulation. And hopefully light-handed regulation means that it's actually productive. But unfortunately, given where we are today, the presumption that any new regulation will be useful relative to where we've been is very, very weak. And so I predict essentially the same pattern will hold until there's a change, not only in administration, but a change in heart.
What other quick follow-up, Professor? The Illinois economy, you know, with all the public debt, the pension debt, what's the outlook for Illinois?
Well, this is a bankrupt state in many ways. Too many years of one-party rule and too many sweetheart arrangements. I mean, just to give you one illustration, you're running acute financial distress and you do the following. You decide to allow a card check for public unions, which essentially means that they're going to win more elections than beforehand and get larger wages. And you don't think of this in the abstract as a card check. What you think of it is a transfer payment, and a transfer payment that this state can ill afford. To give you another illustration, they raised the tax rate from, 3 to 5% in a rump parliament. One of my close friends turns out to be Barbara Curry, who is the wife or the widow now of my late and great colleague David Curry, and she's, I guess, the assembly leader, second in command. And I said to her, Barbara, this will do nothing but harm to the economy. And she says, well, we'll pay off our debts. And I said, no, you won't. And sure enough, what happens is the large companies threaten to leave because the 2% tax turns out to be $25 to $50 million. Governor Quinn comes back and says, we have to give you a break. And if you recall the theme that I was talking about the dangers of discretion in government. The moment you start giving high taxes and you have politically influential people, all of a sudden you'll start getting ad hoc concessions. And so they should have kept the tax rates lower and try to recruit businesses from out of the state. And that, of course, is exactly the strategy of Mitch Daniels when you start looking into Indiana. Come over to my side of the border. We have a much more friendly inquiry or economy than you do. And I just don't think there's anybody inside the administration at the state level who essentially believes that the way in which you get business is to allow it to keep a large share of its profit, and that the successful government wants to get a small share of a large pie rather than a large share of a small pie.
I couldn't agree more, Professor. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, thank you, sir. 312-591-7200. A direct word to my listeners, and particularly to friends who call in. Don't be inhibited. We don't have the full range of calls in front of me on the board. That is because you're listening to a very brilliant fellow, and that makes you a little nervous about getting involved because you can't match the brilliance of the person that you're talking to. Nonsense. He just sounds brilliant. He's actually just an ordinary guy.
I'm an ordinary Joe.
312-591-7200. I really need some good calls, so do get in there quickly. We go next to Mary. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. Is there still a chance that our constitutional republic can get turned around, or is the last 100 years of progressivism inevitable for our country?
Well, I mean, you know, this is a very profound question. It turns out younger countries tend to be more vigorous, and older countries tend to worry about losing their wealth rather than losing their edge. And so to some extent, the longer we go on, the worse to some extent that it becomes. And what you really need to do is to find out ways to do reinvigoration, and that is to extol the old values. There was, I thought, a particularly intelligent but unfortunate column today by David Brooks in the New York Times. He's a University of Chicago type. And he was saying, in effect, is we were a young nation in 1932 when we managed to revive ourselves. We're an old nation now. Then we were trying to create. Now we're trying to preserve. And I don't think that's the right attitude at all. I think what we have to do is to recognize that both of these progressive movements were to some extent big mistakes. The least offensive portion, and this is ironic, of the New Deal was its public works expenditure programs, because they were actually much better at expending public works programs than they did now, because they had more bridges and less red tape in terms of the way in which they operated it because of the general regulatory environment. But the real dangers of the New Deal lay in the regulatory structures that are still with us today, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and so forth. And I think it's just very difficult to do that. But what you have to, I think, impress upon people is the notion that the only way people will be allowed to succeed is if they're allowed to fail. And when they fail, you have bankruptcy as an ordinary liquidation process. And if you have an open economy, what happens is you take the pieces of the failed enterprises, recombine them into new enterprises, and the people who have lost on their luck the first time will have a greater set of opportunities on the second time and could use the experience and the wisdom they gained from their initial failure to other jobs. But the moment you start cushioning people from those losses, it means that everybody else has to start to pay taxes to keep them in place. So the upside of the really intelligent and vibrant people is going to be cut down, and the willingness of people to take risk, foolish risk in many cases, will be increased because they know that there's going to be a soft landing at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a mistake to try to do that. And what you have to do, therefore, is to say, look, and I always try to say this, is the only philosophy that will get you rich is the only philosophy that will keep you rich. The moment you start saying, gee, we've got enough of this economic prosperity, we now have to worry about income cushions and safety nets for everybody else, at that time what happens is your safety net after a while becomes a smothering blanket and kills off initiative.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I just hope that we can elect people to public office locally and at the state level and at the federal level who don't believe in progressivism, who do believe in our constitutional republic, and who can help us turn this around.
Well, I certainly agree. Unfortunately, they don't seem to be clambering out of the woodwork today.
No, there seems to be a timidity to admit. Liberals never have a hard time screaming and letting us know who they are, but our conservatives are a little more timid, and I wish they would be more outspoken.
Yeah, I think a little more direct confrontation on some of these issues would be a good thing.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, ma'am, for the call. We'll go directly to the WGN newsroom and David Jennings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to your calls to Richard Epstein on 312-591-7200. And Gordon is next up. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Mr. Epstein, you stated that you preferred having a flat income tax. I would wonder if you give a nice rigorous defense to that versus having a national retail sales tax to fund taxes where it's more voluntary, where an income tax is still under duress, and it doesn't allow proper freedom of when and what kind of tax as an individual in the Republic I wish to pay.
Well, let me see if I could do it this way. The more important feature to me is the flatness, which is what a national sales tax is. The difference is one does it by aggregate income and the other or consumption, and the other tends to do it piece by piece. And if you had a flat consumption tax done on aggregate income or a flat tax on actually with voluntary market transactions, they would be pretty much the same thing. The major difference being that if you do it on a piece-by-piece basis, the government, which I think is a good thing, does not get centralized data. The big problem one has to face is how you get from here to there. And there's no way you're going to get rid of the income tax at this particular point. And the most dangerous thing in the world is to create two instruments of taxation which can clash with or complement one another. That's what we have with the estate tax and with the income tax, for example. So I'm willing to go along with that in an ideal world. In the current world, what I would like to do is to first flatten the tax bracket and then to narrow the base in a certain way by taking out various stock transactions which allow people to reinvest from one kind of business into another free of capital gains tax. There's a movement to that way generally, but essentially the simplest way to do that right now is to say if in fact you sell a share of stock and reinvest the proceeds within the next 6 months, it doesn't matter whether or not it's a part of a reorganization or some kind of privileged transactions, you don't pay tax on the gain. You just put in the basis for the new stock, the basis of the old stock, so that the gain will be the same when you ultimately liquidate it out. But the key point is to get rid of the discretion. What happens now is that if you can decide, well, you know, we'd like the tax on the rich to be 40, 50, 60% and on the bottom to be zero, there's a political incentive for people who pay nothing by way of additional marginal taxes to vote additional set of benefits that are going to be paid for by others. And this tends to lead to them overconsumption of these benefits for which they pay only a partial price.
Yes.
It turns out they pay a much larger price than that because, as we see today, as you start to reduce the level of incentives for gain at the top, there's less money to transfer to the bottom. And the purpose of a flat tax, which I argued in this little book, is to make it politically sustainable. In a flat tax, the only differences that matter are estimations as to the value of government certain government public projects vis-a-vis the cost. But if everybody is richer off with a flat tax than they are with no tax, so long as the tax is on everybody or on nobody, people will basically make honest estimations as to whether the public expenditure is worth it in terms of the things forgiven by private individuals, they can't do them anymore, and the things that you could get through public. And that's the key feature in this system. And under the current system, with 50% of the population not paying income tax, and the Social Security system being completely scrambled up, the tax structure writ large is, in fact, counterproductive to productive labor. And in the end, I mean, George Stigler used to say this a long time ago. He's now dead over 20 years. He says production always swamps redistribution as a social policy. And he was right.
But as a quick follow-up to that, I know you're speaking as a macro level, but more of a micro level. If we had a consumption tax, then an individual would see possibly what their tax burden is. It's not hidden in the current leviathan of the central government, or maybe it'd make us a little more active as individual citizens to keep a check on the cost of our government.
Well, look, I mean, if you had accurate reporting, it would make a difference. Right now, when you put Social Security tax down, it's not listed as Social Security. It's listed as FICA, something else you don't understand. If you look at the actual benefits that you get from these various programs, they never give you present value equivalents to what you have, like you get from your standard Fidelity fund. A lot of what you're talking about could be handled by more accurate reporting requirements, which would give people better information as to what the government is doing with respect to the money. But there is a very systematic effort on the part of people who are in favor of redistribution to conceal it from the public at large in order to find there's less resistance to it.
Right. You know, just the whole fact that so much of our taxes are hidden and we don't have a real you know, when you get to, if you work on a W-2, you don't think about what your gross is. You can't spend your gross. You only look at your net. You're not even seeing the punishment you're taking by your withholding taxes.
Well, I mean, to some extent, remember, it was Milton Friedman who invented this system during the Second World War. My view about it is I think withholding tax actually prevents cheating, and it's probably a relatively good thing. But I do think, in effect, that people should be told to look more carefully at all the deductions and holdouts.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Interesting contribution, valuable for us. We go directly to the next caller, that being Joseph, who's reached us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I would like your opinion.
This is a kid fooling around, and his father shouldn't have allowed him to do that. Too bad about that, because the question was a good one. He was supposed to ask about what's wrong with Obamacare and how you would fault it.
That's not a bad situation to ask. It's a very complicated program because there's so many moving parts to it. Let me just mention a couple of them. One of them, which I think is many of the most dangerous features, has to do with the very powerful mandates that the federal government puts on the states with respect to Medicaid. What it says, in effect, is we're willing to give you certain kinds of funds, but then you're going to have to match them with monies of your own. And by the way, if you don't want to take our particular money, we're going to put even heavier burdens upon you. And if you actually try to cash out what these burdens are, it essentially allows the federal government to determine whether or not states will have enough money to depend on education in schools or parks or all sorts of other programs that they try to run their own. And so there's a lot of constitutional pushback on that. But again, it's always an uphill battle. It's one I'm involved with, by the way, because the dominant attitude with respect to economic affairs under the American Constitution, as construed by our Supreme Court, is the so-called rational basis test, which means if you could show any one good thing about a public program, the fact that it has other demerits means it's for the political branches and not for the courts to decide. And there's no program that's that big that doesn't benefit somebody. It would never get passed if it hurt everybody. And so it's always a rational basis. So it's the Medicare stuff. And then the one that's most commonly known is, of course, the stuff having to do with the individual mandate, where the theory is in order to make sure that you could keep people who need medical care but can't afford it in the system is you overtax those people who essentially could provide for themselves at much less money. And what you do now is you allow the federal government essentially to announce to the world that if you decide to breathe or to drive your car across state lines, we can now impose a tax upon you, not in order to provide for the common good, but essentially to fund this transfer system. And it turns out that when you start running mandates like that, there's no natural limit as to how much of this that you can do, and that the benefits that you supply on the other side are simply too rich to be sustainable. If you look at the so-called minimum package of benefits that required of private plans and so forth, they're so dense and so expensive that they bear no relationship to the kind of expenditures that people would make if they had their own money to put on the line and had to choose between, say, more food or more health care. It could easily lead for many people in the under, say, $35,000 a year income bracket to spend over a third of the income that they have on these kinds of things. They don't pay for it. So somebody else is paying for it. So you then have an elaborate system of direct regulations as to how much an insurance company or a healthcare provider can charge in order to put this in place. There's a key figure known as the medical loss ratio. And what this says, in effect, is you've always spent 25% on administering your plans, but we're smarter than you are. Competition is inefficient, so we're going to limit you to 15% of what you take in, and you have to refund the excess to your customers. And if you actually don't give waivers to those things, you bankrupt the programs. And so there's just this endless battle. Things that used to be called administrative expenses, companies desperately try to reclassify as medical expenses and so forth. And the whole thing will be a regulatory morass from which we will not come out. The Daniels plan, which I had referred to before, essentially makes grants to individuals to help them with medical care. So you get $3,000, I think, off the top, and you can spend it as you will. And if you don't spend it, you could keep it, which is an incentive. Then there's a copayment period. And then if there's catastrophic losses, the government will pick up virtually all of it. But you design the kinds of care that you want with the money that you get. So you're not constantly trying to push and pull the regulated industries in ways which make them unviable. There is a a division of opinion between some people who think that Obama's in favor of this because he wants to kill the insurance companies and other people who say, no, he's not trying to kill them. He's just trying to co-opt them. But I don't care so much about that debate. I'm pretty convinced that the level of care that ordinary Americans will receive when, as, and if this program goes into effect will be less responsive to their needs than they could get under the current system, particularly if we reform that system by removing some of the mandates and opening up entry to competition across state lines, allowing emergency facilities to be funded by Walmarts and CVC. So the difference in strategy, and this goes back to the point that Milt made at the outset on how you organize these shows, the classical liberal tries to discipline current powerful entities by having new entry, which costs the government nothing but puts competitive pressure on the incumbents. And what the progressive does is he ties up the market so he could regulate a relatively few firms and then says, I'm smart enough to figure out how it is that the government and the regulated industries can divide the spoils. And it turns out nobody's that bright.
Did you work for Ed Levy? Did you come to the law school when Ed Levy was dean of the law school or president of the university?
I came when he actually was 1968. I guess he was president of the university. And I knew Edward.
Because, of course you did.
And Kate. He had been at the law school. And Bernie Meltzer, who is one of my late colleagues, all these people unfortunately are gone now, was his brother-in-law.
The reason I ask is I wonder if you would compare his achievements as Attorney General of the United States, which he was for a few years, with the current Attorney General.
Well, Edward Levy was one of the great figures in American public life, widely admired by people on all sides of the political spectrum. He served a relatively short period of time from February 1974 to, I think, the beginning of 1977. So he had a couple of years in office. But what he brought to the office was a sense of probity. I mean, the story that was told about Edward is some assistant attorney general wants to do some particularly obnoxious thing. And what he does is he hands Mr. Levy a document and says, sign it so I can go ahead with my business. And what Levy does is astonish the poor young man by taking the document, putting it in his briefcase and saying, when I read it at home tonight and understand what it's about, I'll let you know whether I'm going to sign it. And that one kind of symbolic gesture meant that the attorney general was not going to let lesser underlings run riot over various kinds of issues. And it's not that he was a great man as an attorney general because of the lawsuits that he initiated and so forth. What he did was essentially bring back a sense of confidence and trust in the American people that there was an honest and fair man running this.
Now look to the present attorney general.
Well, Holder, I mean, he's not my favorite attorney general, and he's been a disappointment. The first thing you should note is he was once deputy attorney general, and in that role was one of the champions of these highly draconian rules that were designed to force corporations into plea bargains, even when it turned out that they were not guilty of anything. And these were real offenses to due process, stripping them of various kinds of defenses unless they ratted on their own people. And you have to understand the clout in this game is that if you're a corporation and you get sued, you lose your licenses, you're out of business. And if it turns out you're convicted, oh, you got to pay $1 million fine. So the suit is more powerful than the fine, and you have much more protection against the fine than you do against the suit. So this inversion of the relationship between responsibility and protection is essentially led to a lot of abuse, and he was a guy who exploited that. And I thought that was very bad. In his current situation, I think he's too much of a presidential partisan, and the continuity between politics and adjudication is very troubling. I don't believe that they have a case, for example, on the voter fraud stuff. I mean, you know, the requirement that somebody show an ID card with a picture on it is, you know, required by credit card companies, required by all sorts of people. You're willing to give the cards out for free. It's an important anti-fraud device, and to see in this a kind of insidious civil rights violation, I think, is a mistake.
Yeah, it's also a door through which illegals can enter and get into the voting booth.
Yes.
And the expectation is probably that illegals will vote for us rather than for the other guys.
Well, I mean, and in other areas, you know, I just am not impressed by the way in which he's behaved. And I think he's something which Edward Levy never was. He's a political partisan.
We go back to the phones in an instant, or actually in about 3 minutes after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we'll go back to the phones in an instant, but I can't resist the following. I'm getting back to present politics in a way. You would agree that the public the most public libertarian at the moment is Ron Paul. I know that it doesn't follow that you therefore support Ron Paul or that you're that kind of libertarian. But how do you feel about the way in which he, and I think lots of other political libertarians do the same, eschew any kind of further involvement in the world, essentially take a position which is a renewal of old-fashioned isolationism?
Well, I'm not an isolationist. I mean, a libertarian who's a classical liberal believes that there are relatively few occasions when you use force, mm-hmm. but when you use it, you want to use it in a decisive way. That is, the last thing you want to do is to try to do just enough to win because you end up losing. That's what we did in Vietnam, and that's exactly what we're doing now in Iraq. I mean, you know...
Well, we're no longer doing it in Iraq.
Well, we are doing it in Iraq by pulling it out and announcing that we're not going yeah. back. While the cat's away, the mice will play, and the disintegration of their political institutions.
I think Iraq will break apart in a year.
Well,
Iran will dominate the
Middle East.
The Middle East, yeah.
You know, and this is Obama not understanding things.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be prepared to use force to be a successful president. Now, the single most difficult choice that you have to make is the libertarian theory will give you all sorts of explanations when you're entitled to use it, but it has no theories when you ought to use it. So there are many cases, for example, which says that I am entitled to intervene in a dispute to protect Mr. A from being assaulted by Mr. B, but I'm not duty-bound to do it. Well, when do I go in and when do I stay out? All of the writers who talk about the use of force in international affairs start with these humble analogies, and it turns out, you know, having taught torts, you know, the subject that deals with this for all my professional career, you come up with the conclusion, there are lots of close cases, and you have to do what is reasonable under the circumstances, which is an open invitation for honest disagreement by people acting in good faith. And that's the political situation. So that to be an isolationism is essentially to commit yourself to a non-force policy, when in fact, if you do that, everybody else knows how you're going to play your hand. They start to know how to play their hand, and they will take terrible advantage with respect to you. So you have to be prepared to use force in order to prevent force, and then the only questions are how the tactics work. And the isolationist surrenders himself too quickly, and the isolationist is the kind of guy who will appease a guy like Hitler when it comes to 1938, because after all, what the hell does the Sudetenland have to do with anything that I want? And then you slowly find out that you creep back. And one of the things I actually admired about George Bush is that he was prepared, and I think rightly so, to, once things started to turn very bad in Iraq in 2006, to favor the surge, which actually worked. And Obama criticized that and wanted to pull out. And I regard him essentially as somebody who has never mastered the art of when it is you hold them and when it is that you fold them. And his ability to announce positions in advance that give everybody else a free rein is a disaster. So, I mean, if you were somebody who was opposed to American rule, like Sadr, whatever his name is, Sadr in Iraq, you're not going to start something up while we're there if you know that we're going to leave on December 23rd without fail. You'll wait till Christmas Day and then you'll launch your bombs. Well, why do you want to make the world so easy for everybody else? And so the correct view of thinking about a libertarian is you limit the occasions under which you use force and you try to get them right, but you never announce in advance that we're going to withdraw from the rest of the world. And you're certainly not going to do it on force, because the moment you do it on force, people are going to start to want to do it on trade, which is again another disaster. And so I just don't think that either Ron Paul or Barack Obama know what it is to be a commander-in-chief, because they've never thought through the kinds of subtle positions you have to take in this very difficult game, where it turns out the world will not be, shall we say, seduced by your rhetoric, or will succumb to your wiles. And Obama thinks he could talk his way out of anything. And, you know, those are guys, he's like John Lindsay when he was mayor. He was taken for a ride by Mike Quill, if you remember the strike on 1965 New Days.
Yeah.
And the president essentially rolls over and dies. And this is not what you want in public affairs.
Hear, hear. Quickly back to the phone. 312-591-7200. James is next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, I've got a question with regard to the unemployment benefits. As we keep extending them, some politicians say that it's the most no-brainer thing to do because it's automatically going to help the economy because people who get them are going to spend them. I don't really agree to that, but I don't know how to explain whether that's true or not true, and I was wondering if you could explain.
It's terrible. I mean, look, the first of all is if you have a system which says only one thing will be the consequence of another thing that you do, then you want to devote all your resources to it. So if you think 99 weeks is a good system and what it does is it stimulates the economy and creates more benefits than it imposes costs, then why not 150 weeks? Why not give everybody lifetime unemployment benefits so that nobody has to work at all would be the reductio ad absurdum of this. So there's got to be a force that's putting and pushing you in the opposite direction, which says maybe this is too long. And here let me mention to you two of these forces. One of them is the issue of moral hazard. And this was widely understood and accepted even by liberal economists before the political debate, which is that people get unemployment insurance. Some of them will have a tendency to put off looking for a job so long as the unemployment benefits plus the self-help around the home would exceed what they could get from labor. And in fact, if you tax labor higher in order to support the unemployment benefits, the private return will be smaller and people will be even more reluctant to go back to work. So you can't expend it. And indeed, what Germany did in order to boost its economy is it cut them back to about 52 weeks, I think it was. Don't hold me to that. And it actually had a positive effect because some people now decided they really had to do it. The second problem with this stuff is if you're going to give benefits to somebody, you got to take them from somebody else. Well, whom are you going to start to take them from? Well, if you put a tax on capital in businesses and you now remove this money to the public sector, they have less by way of resources to hire other individuals. So that what happens is you now create a situation where people who currently have jobs may not be able to maintain them because the revenue streams needed to support them have been reduced by public taxes. So what you do and what the president always does is he counts all the jobs created by the programs that he puts there, miscounts, but that's the small point, but he never counts the jobs lost when these things are created. We know what the aggregate number is because we have these very large stimulus programs and these things remain relatively stable. And the only way in which you'll start to get things better is if people believe that there's a chance that you're not going to play these kinds of games. So this is the key point. It's the short-term payroll stimulus does nothing for long-term employment. What will do this is a stable environment in which people will know what their future taxes are and their future regulations are. And today we have a massive level of uncertainty in dealing with, for example, labor organizations, which retards expansion in retail trades, which are subject to unionization, for example. And every major tax rate that we have in the United States is subject to modification or renewal within the next, 24 to 36 months. The estate tax, the income tax, the capital gains tax, that's no way to run a ship. And one of the reasons why you like the flat tax is it turns out that there are fewer degrees of freedom in government, and so your time horizons become longer, which means that the government, instead of being a source of uncertainty and therefore wealth destruction, becomes a source of certainty and therefore wealth creation.
Sir, we thank you for the call, and we are virtually out of time. In 2 minutes, I just have to ask you the most profound question I've come up with all night. So what else is new?
What, in my own life? Is a busy fellow trying to write something. I will plug my next book.
Please.
Which is I'm just about finished with another book which will come out from the Harvard University Press, which is a big book, which is called The Classical Liberal Constitution.
Uh-huh.
And the point of this book is a soup-to-nuts examination of all the structural and individual liberty stuff from a historical, economic, and legal perspective as seen through the eyes of somebody who was raised in the classical liberal tradition.
So you'll come back here and discuss it?
I will certainly do that.
Which I should make clear to those who are listening that though I've stressed that you are from the Law School of University of Chicago, in fact, these days you are still a lecturer there, but you've basically shifted to the law school at New York University.
My full-time appointment is at NYU, and I'm doubly blessed by two wonderful institutions to work at.
And also your
Hoover Institution.
Fellow at the Hoover Institution.
Yes, I'm bicoastal. The thing I like to say about it is the three greatest institutions I could ever be associated with in the three most malgoverned states that you can imagine in the United States.
Well, your presence in all three may set a corrective process in motion. I have to say a few quick things about things to come. We will not be here tomorrow night. There's a one-hour program after the ball game, but it'll be filled by somebody else. I'm busy doing other things. But we'll be back on Thursday night with a full two-hour program in which we do, as we do annually, a review of the year on Extension 720. Basically, a lot of clips from some of the programs that particularly pleased the listeners. And I do want the other things coming next Sunday, next Monday, but I do want particularly to mention that Tuesday next week will be our night at the Lyric Opera, and the new director of the opera, Anthony Freud, will be one of our guests, as will a number of others, including some of the performers in the current season. That's Tuesday next week from 10 midnight, of course. And with that, warm thanks to an old friend, Richard Epstein, and thanks to all for listening. We'll be back again with you on Thursday night. Until then, a most cordial good night to all.